Someone inquired about where you could get the book that we discussed yesterday, and that raises that whole question. I've taken it up with the people in the bookstore, and they felt that I have to talk with somebody else. So I will do that. And what I would like is if the bookstore would undertake so that anybody who wanted to place an order could have the book sent to their home. That's would be the best thing. There will be a copy in the library where you can look at it a little more definitely, and there are a few copies for sale in the bookstore. One or two copies, I guess, from each of the books, so that you won't have to order it without having a chance to look at it if you are interested in ordering. That's any one of the books that we're including the one yesterday, you know.
And I'm just wondering which translation you
want. Well, there are several translations that I like. I put down this one. I can't even remember Gardner translation in the list here. I also am a great champion of the Whitford translation. I don't know if that's in paperback, however, but this one is in paperback and is a very fine translation.
There's a one that's a rather modern one in this Pelican book series.
The Confessions.
Yes.
Well, I don't happen to know that one.
Which is in paperback.
It mentions a Pelican edition of Augustine's Confessions, too, and it's wonderful how they can continue to translate these things in a very interesting way. So we'll find out more about any procedure. However, I did put on the list, and we do have lists for those who are interested in having them, of the whole 100 books. Now, we won't discuss more than a small part of those, but the list is here, and it includes the publisher and, of course, the author and title. So, and the year it's published. So if you want to bother to order directly from the publisher, that can be done too. Now, I thought you'd be interested in knowing which books we'll be taking up next. Wednesday, we won't have any discussion this hour. I guess there's a mountain hike or mine hike or something at that hour. And Thursday is 4th of July and McCarthy Day, I guess, so we won't have anything that day. But on Friday, we'll discuss this, probably the greatest of the encyclicals of Pope John, Pacem in Terris, a very wonderful document, as I'm sure those of you will agree who have read it. An epoch-making document, really. And then on Monday, there's a little book that means a great deal to me. I don't know how many of you know it, by Olive Wyand, called Living Springs, which is a study of Christian communities, particularly in Western Europe and in England. It's a marvelous little book, Living Springs by Olive Wyand. And then on Tuesday, a book that Georgia Harkness has recently edited on a selection of devotional writings from the early church. All of us perhaps know some of the names of those writers, but their writings are not well known, and now it's very easy to get acquainted with them through this little book by Georgia Harkness, a devotional treasure from the early church. Then on Wednesday, next book, I thought we would take a look at the Christian church in all its branches, or its various branches, as discussed in Newbegin's The Household of God. Now, I don't know how many of those books you're familiar with, but these will all be available so that you can, let me see now, Devotional Treasury, Living Springs, Pacem in Terris, Household of God. I think those will all be available in the bookstores. Not many copies can be purchased, but then in the library. Well, that really is the questionnaire. I have quite a few lists of the books. If you want one, take it. If you don't want to care for, if you don't really care to have it, but just want to look it over, that's all right too, so that we don't make use of it if you'd like to have it. Now, yesterday we talked about, we were discussing Stringfellow's My People is the Enemy. And after the hour was over, then I said to myself, well, I didn't really make very explicit what I consider to be the main point in these discussions. I'm not interested, and I don't think you are very interested in just discussing a book for the sake of criticism of it. But what we really are interested in is what does it have to say to us that is of value for Christian thought and Christian life? What is there there that points up? Of course, most of the books won't have all these things new, but they will seek to point out certain things. And I sat down and I said to myself, well, now what do we get out of this book of William Stringfellow's? And I wrote down a number of points. Now just read those over before we go on to the other book. These things, it seems to me, are rather, you might say, self-evident in a careful study of My People as the Enemy. First, we did discuss this yesterday, of course, the importance of maintaining one's identity in all circumstances. Well, we didn't really discuss it very much. We mentioned it. That's about it. And it certainly deserves much more discussion, this matter of retaining your identity, whether you go to live among the Indians or you go to Harlem or you are in the upper classes or lower classes. And secondly, to make a proper distinction between social reform and the gospel. Now, that's very easy to write a sentence like that, but to do it is difficult. But I think Stringfellow challenges us to do it. A third, and this is of course too obvious to mention even, to be concerned for the needs of the poor. That's generalized and well repeated. Then the evil of racism. It is a pointed book on the evil of racism. And as I said yesterday, Stringfellow sees that evil, saw that evil several years ahead of most of our thought leaders and church leaders. Then the present more immediate physical danger to the whites in the North. That's an actual fact that he points out. Then the centrality of devotion to the Bible in Christianity. It seems, just to make a comment on that, it seems strange after 1900 years of Christian history that that Protestantism, more especially liberal Protestantism, I'm not talking about old-time Lutheranism or the old-time Baptist churches, but liberal Protestantism, which has dominated the scene in America for 2-3 generations now, headed up in the National Council of Churches and so on, that to such an extent, of course, there's a wave of return now. But say 20 years ago, this devotional use of the Bible was practically, well, looked down on. And of course, Stringfellow says it still was in the, among some of his workers there, associates there in East Harlem. So the centrality of devotion to the Bible and Christianity. Then reconciliation. This is something that we should discuss. We didn't discuss it much. Somebody raised a question with me afterwards about it and felt that I hadn't brought that out at all, really. But he does stress that reconciliation, and he's talking particularly, of course, the reconciliation between black and white in our time, in our situation. He says this reconciliation inevitably involves the cross. That is a willingness. Somebody's got to be willing to bear the evil effects both sides of the thing, both on the part of the of the Negro who feels himself oppressed and who shoots, and of the policeman who is the officer of law and who shoots and kills in return. See, somebody's got to be in there and be willing to be killed in the process, as he says, the way Lou Marsh did. He says, this is the way to live. Now we can say, that's foolish, Mr. Trinkle. You don't practice this yourself, and you we don't really believe it. But I think that's what he teaches. And then, well, this is just a further development of that. To live truly is to live at the level of the cross. And of course, I didn't really read anything from that section, but I put it down this way: the church has miserably failed in relation to race. He's got pages up on that, you know. Now we've all heard that in other places, but he certainly, why, he gives examples of the bishops, you know, and how they meet year after year and just simply won't deal with the subject that's right at their door. And then, of course, his emphasis on death. All men are under the inescapable judgment of death. Well, that 10 points seems to me that they're rather sort of on the surface, you might say, of this book. And I just wanted to make them articulate here, because that's what I'd like to have us do in our thinking about these various books. What does it have to say to us in our time and situation? You know, if we should go ahead now and discuss some of these points, then I would get into my old habits, you know, which I know from my classroom days of starting to discuss yesterday's lesson and you never get to today's. So I won't do that, though I think the subjects are worthy of much more discussion than I gave them yesterday. Now today, for those of you who don't know the book, this little book, I count it a great privilege to introduce you to it. Very few books that I am more happy about introducing people to than this one. Filled as it is with suffering and sorrow, Dying We Live. There's a foreword by Trevor Huddleston, but it's edited by Helmut Gollwitzer, who is a very famous theological teacher in Germany, and somebody named Kathy Kuhn, and somebody named Reinhold Schneider. I don't know those other two names. Now these are, and the subtitle says, the final messages and records of some Germans who defied Hitler. So this is what the book is. It's the last messages, or the latest messages, latest and last messages of the victims of Hitler. Most of them are either Catholic or Protestant. A few of them are socialists, or, well, some of them maybe are Christians and socialists too, and unbelievers. So that doesn't come out much, but it's mostly the heroic leaders, heroes, martyrs, the Catholic and Protestant Church in Germany. You know that there have been books written, I guess there's one about the Protestants too, but I'm very familiar, or I'm aware particularly of one by the Catholics, a Catholic writer who analyzes what the Catholic Church did in Hitler's day, and he paints a horrible picture of compromise. Point after point after point, the Church didn't stand up to Hitler, but bowed under and refused to bear the cross. But and this, of course, is true to a considerable extent. Maybe to an equal extent, for that matter, in the Protestant Church as in the Catholic Church. But in the midst of that, you have these great heroic figures. And there are many of them that are listed here. Of course, there are thousands who don't get into any book. you know, who died for the sake of Christ and truth and freedom and humanity under Hitler. But there are many, many right here, and we have, we'll have time just to read a few of the passages from some of these letters. I may say that I feel kind of strange even reading them. They see there seems to be something so sacred about these things that really, you just feel like taking your shoes from off your feet because it's holy ground. But you know, just something just flashed through my mind now, and I paused. I saw that one of the authors is Reinhold Schneider, and I said to myself, well, how did I get Reinhold Niebuhr in there, you know? But I believe, now it comes to me, that I believe that when the first edition of this came out, that was a hardback edition, that the introductions, the introductory statements by Reinhold Niebuhr and George Schuster, who was the great Catholic lay leader, former president of Hunter College, and introducing the book to the American readers. I'm not sure of that, but because I do definitely have George Schuster associated with it too. But those are not given here. This is the English edition, Fontana Books, and Trevor Huddleston is this British Episcopalian Anglican leader in South Africa. So that's explains it. He writes the introduction here. Now let me read just some of these. Some by people that are utterly unknown, and other names that have become famous, you might say, in the world of politics and literature, as well as in the annals of Christian suffering. Now this first one in the book is from a farm boy from the Sudetenland, dated February 3rd, 1944. Dear parents, I must give you bad news. I have been condemned to death. I and Gustav G, we did not sign up for the SS, and so they condemned us to death. You wrote me indeed that I should not join the SS. My comrade, Gustav G, did not sign up either. Both of us would rather die and stain our consciences with such deeds of horror. I know what the SS has to do. Oh, my dear parents, difficult as it is for me and for you, forgive me everything. If I have offended you, please forgive me and pray for me. If I were to be killed in the war while my conscience was bad, that too would be bad, would be sad for you. Many more parents will lose their children. Many SS men will get killed too. I thank you for everything you have done for my good since childhood. Forgive me. Pray for me. It doesn't even give his name. Anonymous. And then a statement by Count York of Wartenburg, who was a member of the so-called Kreisau circle, centering around Count von Moltke. Count von Moltke is one of the just shining figures from Germany of that time. We'll read some extracts from him too. A Lutheran layman, died at the age of 38. And whenever I come across these young deaths, I say to myself, how did these men get to be what they were and do what they were at the age of only 38? Well, now this is his friend, one of his friends from that Kreisau circle, Count York. Here's, this is, see what it says about him. That, like most of the members of the Kreisau circle, he was in the group of activities around Count Stauffenberg, you know, Stauffenberg, the man who organized the attempt to kill Hitler, and it failed, of course. After the abortive attempt on Hitler's life, July 20, 1944, he was arrested and sentenced to death. He's executed on August 8th, 1944, in Plitzensee. There's his last letter to his wife. We have probably come to the end of the beautiful, rich life we lived in common. For tomorrow, the People's Court will sit in judgment on me and others. I hear that the army has expelled me. They can take our garments, but not the spirit in which we acted. And in this spirit, I feel myself in union with my forebears and my brothers and with my comrades. That God has guided events as they have turned out belongs to the inscrutableness of his ways, which I humbly accept. I believe myself to be impelled by a sense of the guilt that is weighing on all of us down, and to be pure in heart. That is why I confidently hope to find in God a merciful judge. The last time we came away from partaking the Lord's Supper, I felt something of almost unearthly sublimity. I should in fact like to call it the presence of Christ. In retrospect, it seems to me to have been a call. My death will, I hope, be accepted as an atonement for all my sins, and as a vicarious sacrifice in expiation of the guilt we all harbor in common. Maybe we say that's theologically incorrect, but who are we to criticize the theology of this man? May it also help to lessen, if only by a hair's breadth, the alienation of our era from God. I, too, am dying for my fatherland, though in appearance my death is an inglorious, even a shameful one. I tread this last path erect and unbowed, and I hope only that you will not see this as an arrogance or a delusion. We meant to kindle the torch of life. A sea of fire engulfs us, and what a fire. Count York. Then we have this very wonderful, I think this is, this very wonderful man, Paul Schneider, a Protestant pastor, one of the very early opponents of Hitler. There's a long sketch of his life and his opposition here. He was forbidden to preach, but he preached just the same. An ominous clash took place when Pastor Schneider, on the burial of a child in his parish, denounced the web of pagan mythology that, for political reasons, was being superimposed upon the Christian concept of the hereafter. Now he had a foretaste of the ordeal that was to come. He was not among those who, resigning themselves into anticipated loss, possessed as though they did not possess. He wasn't one of those who was just resigned to everything. He loved his wife and children with the unbroken strength of a great heart. No one can measure the abyss of suffering, renunciation that he went through. Well, here's one of these. There are several letters from him to his wife and to his family. Let me read just a little. In the eyes of God, it is the spiritual union in faith. This is to his wife. In the eyes of God, it is the spiritual union in faith that is more important, indeed supremely important, especially in the case of husband and wife, who should lift each other heavenward. Haven't we now, dearest, in the course of our wartime separations, discovered this to be true? Your love and your consolation, and I may say your faith as well, have made me happy and helped me to advance along the way of faith that I, or rather that the two of us, have been allowed to follow. Is this not ample recompense for all the outward deprivation and loneliness for each other that we must now bear? That question would bear a good deal of thinking, I think. He says that what we have learned of our love to one another in this time more than compensates for the suffering. That you two are determined not to repine or grieve over it, that is what makes your last letter so precious to me. In fact, this is one of the things that stands out in all these letters. Many of them are to the wives. There are only a few women here who are victims of Hitler. But again and again, the letters show the strange and powerful relationship of love between the husbands and wives as they went ahead. Now toward the end. You see, this was already early in the war, about 1939, or really hardly at the beginning of the war, but the early years of Hitlerism. Shortly before being transferred to the concentration camp at Buchenwald, Paul Schneider, thanks to the kindness of a jail keeper, was able to send a few more lines to his wife. They read as follows, and these are his last lines. "Let us continue to put our trust, as we have done until now, in God alone. Let us continue in humility and patience to expect all good to come from Him alone, and to love, fear, and honor Him wholeheartedly. Then God will be with us, and we shall not be disappointed in our hopes. Be comforted and faithful. Fear not, I hold you close to me, my heart. In God we are not separated." And then a comment at the close. "Despite the horrible torment of concentration camp life and the breakdown of his physical strength, Pastor Schneider brought consolation to his fellow prisoners, and to many of them, acknowledged later, rescue from despair. Even in the camp, he did not cease to speak the truth with his characteristic fearlessness, whereof such testimony was called for. He endured unspeakable suffering. He was tortured almost to death. Finally, a camp doctor murdered him with an overdose of it's a drug anyway. He died on July 18th, 1939. Fellow prisoner pays this tribute to him. In camp like this, for me, the greatest of all trials, to remain silent in the presence of, let's read it on here, in the presence of the sufferings that Paul Schneider was going through. I say he is really one of the great lights that came out of Hitlerism. I don't feel very good about reading very much here, but I wish I could. I think I'll just give you a little bit of the spirit of Count von Moltke. Yes, here he is. He's the one who died at 38. The editor says that he represented, as no one else could, the other Germany, as opposed to National Socialist rulers, the Kreisau Circle. Then it also mentions that von Moltke, both for political and for Christian reasons, opposed the plot to kill Hitler. He felt that this was the wrong procedure. Of course, the plot failed. And I'm sure there were Christians involved in that too. Even Bonhoeffer, I think, was somehow involved in that Stauffenberg plot. But von Moltke felt that was, here's the way it's said to put it here, both as a Christian and as a statesman, Moltke disapproved of the assassination plot against Hitler. He wanted to prepare for the rebirth of Germany after the catastrophe that he foresaw as inevitable. He was executed at Plitzensee, January 23rd, 1945. Bishop Hans Lilje, some of you have heard Bishop Lilje speak, who met Moltke in prison, said, "Without any self-deception as to the probable end, he lived in a serene clarity of spirit a shining example of indomitable firmness based on faith. And this this shines through his letters. You feel that you the death really has lost its power over him. See if I can find a little bit here. In the connection of the at the trial, the decisive pronouncement in that trial was, "Count Moltke, Christianity and we National Socialists have one thing in common and one thing only, that we claim the whole man." That's the statement that's so often associated with Count Moltke. Now did he realize what he was saying? Just think how wondrously God has prepared this unworthy vessel of his. At the very moment when there was danger of my being driven into active preparation for the coup, the Stauffenberg and the others, I was taken out of it so that I am free and remain free of any connection with it of violence. In addition, God had implanted in me the socialistic trait which freed me though owner of great estates, from any suspicion of representing vested interests. Then he abased me as I've never been abased before, and so on. So he feels a strange freedom. I wanted to get that other. Writing to his wife, "Therefore I can say only one thing, dear heart. May God be merciful to you and to me. Then even the death of a husband matters not at all, for he can demonstrate his omnipotence even when you are, yes, he can demonstrate his omnipotence even when you are making pancakes for the boys, or when you have to take Pucci out of the room, although I hope you don't have to do that often. I should be saying farewell to you, but I can't do it. I should be mourning and regretting the drabness of everyday life, but I can't do it. I should indeed be thinking of the burdens that will fall upon you, but I can't do it. I can only say one thing to you, that if you attain to a feeling of supreme security, if the Lord gives you that which had it been for this period in our lives and in conclusion, if the Lord gives you that which had it not been for this period in our lives and its conclusion, you would never have had, then I am leaving you with a treasure that cannot be confiscated, a treasure compared to which my life would be a small amount. Therefore, there are these Romans, these wretched creatures, Schuler and Friedler, these are people that were persecuting him, and whatever their names of the pack of them may be, they would not even understand what it is that they have missed. Well, I do a poor job of reading, but when you read a passage like that, you feel that here's somebody who is living on a completely different plane. Death doesn't have any power over him at all. There's a love that is stronger than death. That's written in the Bible, but this illustrates it. I just mentioned one other person here, and that's this wonderful Edith Stein. I almost said Gertrude Stein, a very different type of person. Edith Stein, who was of Jewish blood, but early in life had been converted to Catholicism, or maybe not very early, but at least earlier, and become a Benedictine nun, Sister Theresa Benedicta. And she was in Holland when the Germans overwhelmed Holland and was taken prisoner and sent to the east, where she perished, we suppose. Well, I think it's definitely put in the gas chambers. Now, she was not only a wonderful person, this beautiful spirit, but a great intellectual light of the highest order. She was a close assistant of Professor Husserl. Those of you who read philosophy know at least the name of Husserl, one of the outstanding people in our time, and I suppose the philosophical father of Heidegger, whom we mentioned yesterday, and I suppose most people say that Heidegger is the greatest living philosopher, or one of them anyway. And so she was right there at the top intellectually, and wrote a number of books. And from one of these earlier writings, you have this statement. This is not and from her, it's not from a letter, and it's not from her very last days, but a little bit earlier. So I just want to read this one paragraph. Edith Stein. I'd like to have you, if the name is not familiar to you, put it in your, trace it in your mind. There's a beautiful life of Edith Stein called The Scholar and the Cross. God demands nothing of man without at the same time giving him the strength to accomplish it. Faith teaches this, and the experience of life, of the life of faith, confirms it. The innermost part of the soul is a vessel into which the Spirit of God flows when by virtue of freedom it opens itself to him. And God's Spirit is mind and strength. He gives new life in the soul and makes it capable of achievements which of its nature alone it would not be equal to. And at the same time he gives it direction to its activity. Well, that written earlier from a book called Faith and Eternal Being. Is that it? Finite and Eternal Being is a sort of a pattern of her later life. Well, as I say, I almost it's one thing to read William Stringfellow, but it's another thing to read this. But it's the kind of a book that you like to have on your shelf and not really to read through. I don't think I've ever read it through. But you can pick it up anywhere, and it's filled with light and challenge and power. Now, if we were to, I look at some other names here. For instance, this that was not the name that I wanted to see. Here's for instance, Ernest von Harnack. Most of us know the Harnack, the great liberal theologian. Here's a member of that same family. Alfred Delp was a Jesuit. That's a tremendous story in itself, Alfred Delp, and his martyrdom. And then this dean of the cathedral of Bernard Lichtenberg, the dean of the cathedral in St. Hedwig in London. You know, we're talking, Gracia, with the Aiden, what is her name? Aideners the other day, and Mrs. Aideners' name was Hedwig, to which I told her I liked the name. I didn't tell her wholly why I liked it, but, and then he said that, well, you know, that's the name of a great cathedral in Berlin. I didn't know that at the time, but here I read that, that Bernard Lichtenberg, one of these very shining heroes, was the dean of the cathedral of Saint Hedwig in Berlin. It's a strange thing how once a name becomes familiar to you, or you hear it and it sticks in your mind, then you run into it every now and then. Just like here the other day, Jeb Carroll brought up the writings of Charles Williams. Now, I hadn't thought of them for quite some time. I'm sure that I'll be running into Charles Williams on this camp right and left, or around Old Village. Well, now, if we should ask, if we may do that, even regarding a book like this, what would we say would be some of the main points that the book makes? What would we say?
I'm struck by the serenity in the face of death. which seems to be a something in common with all of them.
That's right. It's exactly
from the farm boy to the count.
That's right. Yes. And here I was reading just recently again, somebody whose first name was Hilda, I forget her last name. Both she and her husband, her son was born in prison. You know, her husband had been killed, and her son was born in prison, and she was executed. She writes in this letter about her dreams for her little boy. Well, you see, as difficult as circumstances I could imagine, and yet the same thing you can say is true there. Yes, I think that is.
And you hear so many people saying, what a terrible world to bring a child into, you know. They don't know why people want to inflict the world upon them. And you see these people in real desperate circumstances with hope still the primary.
What do you think of that statement? It's too terrible a world to bring children. You seem to disagree.
I couldn't say why, taking it from the morning lecture. It's something I feel inside, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, but that statement is wrong.
Yes. Yeah. It has to be wrong, or we may as well go cut our throats.
Yes, I think that's right. And what you are really implying here, I think, is that it's impossible. Is it possible to imagine a worse situation than those people had under Hitler in Germany? I mean, those who came in the line of that thrust, or in the way of that thrust. And if people could live and talk as Count Moltke did there, when they've taken everything, of course he doesn't have any more estates. And they're threatening his life. In fact, I think in one of these letters he quotes that, let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also. Yes, I think the point you make is very, very true. It shows that there's something. Love is stronger than death. Yes. What would you say about well, let me just mention, I imagine that some of you have seen that play somewhere. I don't know who wrote it, but it pictures a scene practically duplicating Bonhoeffer's situation.
And Cup of Trembling.
What's that?
Cup of Trembling,
yes. Do you know who wrote it? I know it's
no, because it's a very poor play based on a very good book, and I'd rather, so I want to forget who did it.
That's pretty good. I'm interested that you say that. I didn't like it either, but maybe for a different reason than what you said. And the rest of you seen that Cup of Trembling? Where did you see it? Do you remember where?
I have read the book. I haven't. Well, I've read the play, but I haven't seen it before.
Well, you mean it was poorly presented, was that it?
No, it's...
Or the play
it plays poorly.
Poor is play. I see. All right.
The question that raises in my mind is that, you know, I view it as some exceptional people that have really got some depth of faith in it. And these people rise out in times like this, but this doesn't generally speak of the common guy that comes through this process. I think of myself more as a common kind of a guy, and as to being able to stand up to that kind of torture, both physically and emotionally. And you wonder, how in the world do you do, or could you, or you can't conceive within your imagination now being able to live up to that or live into that, and yet you can't see the faith in it at that time, nor can you see the support of others, nor these other things, but you still can't imagine yourself. I can't, I feel, being able to live up to those kinds of things that that they did. Mm-hmm. And it scares me.
I understand exactly what you say, because we look into our own hearts. I look into my heart. I feel I'm a pretty weak fellow, you know, probably would be compromising here and there. That's one way. But on the other hand, if the government or the ruling power really required you to do something that you were sure was wrong, then might you not measure up to something that you hardly think now that you would measure up to? You see, that's what they were up against, wasn't it? Particularly, well, in many things, of course, the whole theory of blood and soil, you know, the superiority of the German people to everybody else and the complete dependence upon military power. But you see, especially the persecution of the Jews, you see, and the burning of their synagogues and all the rest of it. Paul Schneider from the beginning, just speaking out against it. Well, what would you do, you young men who are ministers or prospective ministers or prospective Christian laymen, if there's something being done that is specifically evil, should a person speak out against it, or should he say, well, that's the matter for Hitler and that's the Nazi party, I have nothing to do with that? What do you think is the verses you say? We don't know exactly how we would measure up until we were in the situation, but
can't this be related to the passage in Luke where we're told that in times of political persecution such as these, that we need not in beforehand worry about what is to be said or to be done, that the Holy Spirit will provide the knowledge necessary at that time and the strength to carry it through, whatever it may be?
Yeah. That passage applies to exactly that kind of a situation. Doesn't necessarily, of course, you know the joke about the minister who gets up to preach and just trusts in the Holy Spirit, you know. Or like one of my professor friends was speaking at a meeting, and afterwards a layman got up to speak and said, I'm not a learned professor, so I have to depend on the Holy Spirit. Help me. In speaking. No, I think it does apply exactly there.
It seems to me that there are people today, I couldn't say if I would be one or not, but I think our young people are showing their thinking, but I think one of their thinking, and they're willing, a lot of them are willing to sacrifice for what they believe. The big problem is, where shall we set our values? What shall we sacrifice for?
Yes. For instance, let us say the pacifists.
Yeah.
I don't know what your feeling is about pacifism, but certainly many of the pacifists have had a strong conviction that the thing that they're standing against is wrong. And of course, the situation is a little different. It's Bonhoeffer died and has been honored ever since. In some ways, it's easier to be a hero in a great crucial situation like that, then like the pacifist that I met on the little bridge right near our place one night last winter, well, he's a minister's son too, he told me, in one of the hospitals there. Well, everything is so complicated that you can't pass judgment really on is that a punishment, is it an adequate punishment, etc., etc. But doesn't it seem clear, at least, that these men and women say to us that there are times and situations when you have to put your life on the line, and you have to be willing to lose everything, or else life doesn't really mean anything. And of course, we're very much aware that this isn't only Christians who have taken that attitude. Certainly, there have been communist leaders here and there that have gone the same way for their cause.
I think we're seeing it done in very exciting ways right now. Right, me and Dr. Spock in the chat room at Yale.
You're putting something on the line, aren't you?
Yes, they're doing it. But they're perhaps doing it
according to their best understanding.
Well, they've been told to do it. And a lot of them, I understand, they come back and they write, and then they write out of their real being and they say that they've hated what they've done, hated what they had to do. Some of the military men are even putting their lives on the line, coming out against what's being done in Vietnam. I think people on all sides and both sides are putting their lives on the line in a very exciting way. No longer a silent generation.
Carol has made several references, of course, already to the response of youth to the McCarthy challenge, you know? And far be it from us to say that everyone who follows McCarthy is like Count von Moltke, but it does seem to speak of this same thing, that life is something else than just going along with the status quo, whatever that status quo happens to be.
Bearded, long-haired people that make us uncomfortable are intensely idealistic.
Okay. All right.
And of course, one of the differences is that under Hitler's regime, it was impossible to go along with the status quo because he politically translated his reign of terror into the requirement that every German prove that he wasn't a Jew. If you wanted to, you know, be able to get groceries and simple things like that. So that everyone had to put their,
Their
lives on the line.
They
had to make a decision. There was no going along with the status quo.
They did go along with those. There were millions who went along with the status quo.
Well, by proving that they're not a Jew, they're not going along with the status quo. I mean, they're making a decision. It was clear at that point, you know, that they were supporting the suppression of Jews.
Yeah. But isn't that going along with the status quo, or what do you mean by that?
No, the status quo would have been sort of living with the Jews and not thinking
of what I mean by going along with the status quo. I think that when Hitler was in authority in Germany, then to go along with the Nazis was to be in the status quo.
Well, yeah, I don't really think it was, though, because it demanded a certain kind of commitment and activism.
To follow Hitler?
Sure.
The commitment that was demanded was to go against Hitler, because if you went against Hitler, you were in danger of imprisonment and death. If you went along with Hitler, you could go on living the way you always had. It demanded a decision, but the status quo, to continue your life as it had previously been, would be to go along with the government.
Yeah, well, to go against it, it was certainly a more difficult decision to make. But I don't think that Hitler was entirely clear about what his program was. In order to make himself an effective terrorist, he, whether he knew it or not, made himself sufficiently ambiguous that you didn't know whether you were in danger or not. And you always had to constantly recommit yourself to him in order to keep alive. And it wasn't just a matter of sloughing along and you know, managing to be safe out of luck. You had to decide that you wanted to be safe the way he wanted you to be safe.
And of course, there were probably, I suppose, hundreds of thousands who felt that Hitler was the answer. That all this business of mixing up the races and bringing in the Jews and all of that, that this was an evil thing, and that the German race with its pure blood could be the saviors of the earth, you know. I'm sure that's what they taught, you know, and I'm sure there were many people who believed that. The hideous lie.
He was successful.
What's that?
I say he was successful.
Yes, he was, for the time being. And you know, I myself sat in a YMCA meeting in Minneapolis in the early days of the, not too long after Dunkirk, and I can even remember the name of the man who had been the head of Y work in Europe. Tracy Strong, his brother of Anna Marie Strong, you know. He came back to bring the report, and I remember in his talking there in this little group, he said, "You have to be careful because what is said in Minneapolis tonight is known in Berlin tomorrow." He said, "You can't be sure anywhere." And the way he spoke, in fact, I think he said it explicitly, that the British are out of Europe forever. This Dunkirk was. It was the decisive thing, and there'll be no more of this British interfering on the continent. He talked as if the whole thing was settled now, really. The details had to be worked out. So in that time, I didn't know anything, I suppose, and I don't know whether I believed what he said or not. But in that time, to be able to believe that scaffold sways the future and that God is standing there, even though Hitler seemed to be so triumphant. But I don't know, these people, a person like Edith Stein or a person like Count von Moltke, I think they've done what they did, whether they thought that Hitler would rule for 1,000 years. I think they just, right is right, and they took their stand and went that way. But I think that we are called upon to try to think things through in our time, in our situation, to take the stand. Well, take the Vietnam War. Been so ambiguous a thing, and so difficult a thing, that especially people, I think, in positions of great influence, taken some courage to. And yet, now let me, I don't want to go too far along that line, because that's a very cheap way to get out of something. But when I saw that play that you spoke of, the Cup of Trembling.